Next up, I gotta see who's in the room.
I'm back here.
Okay. Next up is Professor Nicholas Johnson. He is Professor of Law at Fordham University School of Law. His law degree is from Harvard. He is the lead author of the first ever law school textbook on the Second Amendment, which we heard at lunchtime, Firearms Law and the Second Amendment, Cases and Materials, soon to be released. He has authored and published more than a dozen law review articles related to the right to keep and bear arms. His topic this afternoon is firearms and the black community, an assessment of the modern orthodoxy. Professor Johnson will be submitting the paper soon. The paper is at tab number 11, and it is a page turner, something I would normally not say about a law review article. This is excellent.
Okay, thanks, good to see you again. So the background on this thing, I actually was solicited to write the starting piece by one of the Harvard journals, and I'd written something for them online, and they said, "What else are you thinking about?" And I said, "Well, I've always been thinking that there's this incoherence in the sort of at least establishment view in the black community about firearms. Firearms ownership and self-defense, given that it is undergirded by this requirement that one trust the state. And if you're looking for constituencies that have good reasons to distrust the state, then the black community is one. And you see currents of that in modern civil rights advocacy all over the place. So I'd always thought, you know, this is sort of an odd thing. So I pitched it to him and actually wrote, started out, it was going to be a 30-page piece, and soon it was a 50-page piece, and then it was 120 pages, and finally it was too long to publish. And I've gotten it back down to about 90 pages, which is sort of what you see that's reproduced. And I'm actually at the stage of the submission process where I'm still looking for comments, and I've gotten some nice and effective comments from Alice and from others in the room. So to the degree that between now and the end of February you've got a chance to look at it, if you've got any comments on it, drop me a line at Fordham and Johnson at Fordham.edu. So I've given you sort of the basic pitch with the suggestion that I saw, and Bob Contra and I have talked about this for many years, and I've talked to other folks about it. I saw this something that was hard for me to explain, and it was also inconsistent with my experience growing up. So I grew up in the mountains in the South, and everybody I knew had guns, and these were all the good, upstanding religious folks. My father and grandfather were preachers. They were all armed. Everybody I knew was armed, and these were the best people in the community, not the worst. So the idea that you would develop what is it I call this modern orthodoxy of the type that was applicable here in the district before the Heller case, where only the worst people in the community were armed, struck me as odd. So this paper then sort of transformed into a kind of a longer treatment that was in effect an effort to try and put Shelley Parker and Otis McDonald in context, and to say that these were not people who had been sort of dragooned into a piece of litigation, but they represented a longer tradition and represented what, on the long view, was really the sort of dominant position in the black community right up through the 1960s. So trying to tell that story was interesting in the sense that I had some background in the history, and there were lots of these stories that people knew about. Everybody knew the Deacons for Defense. People had references to the O.C. Sweet case that everyone knew about. So everyone, I think, who was familiar with this literature had an appreciation for the fact that the NAACP for a long time took a view that was diametrically opposite to the view that they took in the Heller case. So my effort here was to try and unwind that story. So you'll see that the paper comes out in basically four parts. The first part is just the story of state failure. You almost don't even have to tell that story, but some of the highlights are just interesting because there are lots of unknown and some known, but some very sort of creative instances of state malfeasance, state neglect, state malevolence that influence, I think, and should continue to influence the sense that for political minorities, not just blacks, but anyone who thinks they might ever be on the other side of a majoritarian exercise of power. That for political minorities, this is the notion of relying on the state for something as important as your personal security. It just worries. It strikes one as viscerally odd as the idea of having armed for self-defense strikes some on the left. So that's section one. Section two, though, is what I think is the particular contribution of the piece. So what section two recognizes is that traditionally speaking, both at the leadership level and at the grassroots, the black community actually did say, yeah, it is sort of odd to suggest that we should rely on the state for personal security. And what you find is just this remarkable list of people in the leadership and then lots and lots of other unknown folks or lesser known folks at the grassroots who both own firearms, who use firearms for self-defense. And that part shouldn't be surprising. But you're left with this question. So if that's what was going on, how do we explain the kind of dominant theme that comes out of the civil rights movement, but also tracks back to before, certainly the 1950s, all the way through the period post-emancipation. How do we explain this sort of idea that there really was a sort of continuing non-violent political effort? And this is where I think I've made a sort of minor contribution in terms of identifying and refining and then giving a name to this policy. So if you read the piece, you'll see that I talk about it, I call it, quote, the strategic dichotomy. But what it really is a way of explaining why and how the community from the leadership to the grassroots took this view about self-defense that was as strong on self-defense as anything you see in any other context, but also recognized that political violence, for purposes of group advancement, that political violence was folly. So how do you say those two things all at the same time? And is there really this self-defense theme? So first, just a little detail on the self-defense theme. And it's sort of hard talking about this article because I build this case sort of bit by bit. You know, this anecdote, look at what this person said, look at what they did. And it's, you're going through, I've got still that in my office at home, a stack of biographies and other treatments of different people in the sort of black freedom movement that didn't make it, with references that are similarly supportive, that didn't make it into the paper. But the ones that do make it into the paper are from figures like, I mean, it's almost everybody you ever think of. So those in favor of self-defense acting in ways that are supportive of self-defense or are arming themselves explicitly. Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Ida B. Wells, Zora Neale Hurston, Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, Walter White, A. Philip Randolph, Marcus Garvey, Charles Evers, T.R.M. Howard, Lloyd Wilkins, James Farmer, it goes on and on and on. And for each one of these, there is what I've tried to reduce to its bare bones, a kind of distilled treatment of their efforts and their thinking in this context. But as I continue to read it and as people give me feedback on it, I think that eventually I push this to book form, simply because each one of these distilled episodes is itself sort of an interesting kind of story that is the time and the backdrop and all of the nuances that one has to pull out in terms of trying to put together a larger work. So what you get is this clear black tradition of arms that is illustrated. So who's the most pacifist, nonviolent person? So the emblematic individual is Martin Luther King. Here's just an excerpt, and if you're following along, I'm not sure what your pages say, but if you look roughly around footnote 192 and surrounding text, you'll get this treatment of Martin Luther King in 1956. So this is a year into the Montgomery bus boycott. King's house is bombed. He comes home, makes sure his daughter and his wife are okay. The men of the community, and these are the people that I knew growing up, gathered around the house with their arms. Now King sends them away, but the very next day he goes to the sheriff's office and he applies for a pistol permit. Pistol permit is denied. Once the pistol permit is denied, the men of the community again, the solid citizens, the deacons, etc., set up a guard around King's house. So here are a couple of comments. Bayard Rustin, from the north, comes down to help in the movement, and writes back to a friend, the house is a virtual garrison. Reverend Glenn Smiley, Fellowship of Reconciliation, writes back to his employer. King accepts a bodyguard. This is problematic. He is young. The place is an arsenal. Now, he's writing in a sort of non-sympathetic way, but when I read this, I thought, yeah, that's exactly the kind of reaction that everyone that I knew growing up would have thought was appropriate and was entirely consistent with the sort of norms of the community. Now, King becomes this advocate for nonviolent political action, but the thing that we will see is that consistent with his very early treatment of self-defense, his very early acknowledgement of the legitimacy of self-defense, his advocacy of political nonviolence was always distinct from his thinking about self-defense. And that appears in this thing that I call, or this dynamic that I call the strategic dichotomy. And the strategic dichotomy is basically just the idea that political violence is on one side, and it's illegitimate, we ought not go there. Self-defense, on the other hand, is on the other, and it is absolutely legitimate. Now, where do you see this? Not just in King. So I've got lots of detail in the article, and much more detail that didn't make it into the article. This theme appears at least as early as the 1850s in the work and the efforts of Frederick Douglass. So, and people argue about Douglass because he started out with the Garrisonians, he moves later to the more radical abolitionists, and depending on what time period within Douglass's development you're talking about, you get more or less sort of radical sounding statements. But Douglass, even at the point in time when he was sending, or when John Brown was trying to entice him to go off and engage in revolution, Douglass was earnestly practical and recognized that the notion of large-scale political violence was just not the manner in which political minorities were going to be successful in this sort of environment. But what Douglass did say, this is in response to efforts of slave catchers under the Fugitive Slave Act, a good revolver, a steady hand, and determination to shoot down any man attempting to kidnap is one of the better remedies to resolve the problems that were arising in the context of the political debate at the time. Douglass is the beginning. Other places, who else would we look for? Well, W.E. Du Bois. Here he's writing in the context of, this is the aftermath of the 1919 Chicago race riot. So Du Bois says, writing in The Crisis, "Today we raise the terrible weapon of self-defense." And he talks about then the legitimacy of self-defense. And at the end, and this is one of the first places where we get this really sort of cogent capture of the strategic dichotomy. "We must never let justifiable self-defense against individuals become blind and lawless offense against all white folk. We must not seek reform by violence." Now, this goes over and over and over again, but one of the best illustrations of it is in something that I call, in the text, and people are familiar with it, the Robert Williams affair. So Robert Williams, some of you may know, was responsible for a book called Negroes with Guns. So Williams is, he's a Marine, he comes back from the military, and is quickly elected president of the Monroe, North Carolina branch of the NAACP. And he was involved in a couple of altercations before this episode that I'm going to recount for you now. But there was a particular instance where a pregnant black woman was allegedly raped by a white man, and the fellow was acquitted. And after the acquittal, Williams says this publicly, and it's picked up by the national news. "We cannot take these people who do us injustice to the court. It becomes necessary to punish them ourselves." A little more in the interim. And then he says, "If it's necessary to stop lynching with lynching, then we must be willing to resort to that method." Now, this is clear advocacy of political violence. This is over the line. This is in the range of the kind of very, very dangerous rhetoric that the black establishment and the people of the grassroots for nearly a century at this point, had been avoided. So as soon as this occurs, Roy Wilkins of the NAACP calls up Williams and says, "Well, basically, you're fired." He suspends it. This initiates the kind of high-profile debate about this strategic dichotomy that is just rich with detail, and some of that I want to try and summarize for you. So Williams appeals his dismissal to the national convention, basically. And here's what happens. While the committee that assesses the suspension upholds the dismissal, that is, they uphold Wilkins' decision, they also say, we do not deny, but reaffirm, and this is around footnote 240, but reaffirm the right of an individual to engage in self-defense against unlawful assaults. They go on. The NAACP's long support of the right of self-defense is evidenced by our defense of those who have exercised the right of self-defense, particularly in the Arkansas riot case, the Sweet case, this is a reference to the Ocean Sweet case, the events in Columbia, Tennessee, and the Ingram case in Georgia. All of these cases, all of these instances that are referenced here in the quote, I also talk about in other places in the text. So here you've got the body itself saying, listen, this idea of self-defense is very different from the notion of political violence, and we're going to uphold self-defense, and we have done so for quite a long time. So this is a very different NAACP than we see today. Next thing that we get is the debate is not over. The effort that Williams engages in to try and rehabilitate his image provokes a response by Martin Luther King. So Martin Luther King and Robert Williams engage in this public debate where they're exchanging essays, and the essays are reprinted in a variety of different places. Here's Martin Luther King's assessment of LaVoy Wilkins' handling of Robert Williams' statement and then the subsequent dismissal. So King basically systematizes this strategic dichotomy this way. He says, well, the notion of violence in this sort of struggle breaks down into three categories. The first, that is, our reaction ought to be purely nonviolent. He says, it's very difficult. That's not going to attract large masses. It requires extraordinary discipline and courage. The next, he says, and this is the clearest articulation yet, the second response, says King, is implicit in the freedom struggle and should not discourage outsiders from supporting the movement. As he's saying, this should not prevent progressives, it should not prevent people, non-blacks, from encouraging the civil rights effort and supporting the civil rights effort. So here's his characterization. Violence exercised merely in self-defense, all societies from the most primitive to the most cultured and civilized accept as moral and legal. Principle self-defense, even involving weapons and bloodshed, has never been condemned even by Gandhi. When the Negro uses force in self-defense, he does not forfeit support. Again, he's talking about this worry that you lose outside support. He does not forfeit support. He may even win it by the courage and the self-respect that it reflects. And then he goes on and talks about Williams' approach, which he says is basically that old notion of political violence, which, again, is followed. It's still not. The national office is inundated with these responses from the branches. So lots of people from the branches, and this is the place where I just had to leave a lot of stuff out of the article. But there are all of these details that you get from the branches that disagree with the decision to suspend Williams. The debate still rages. Wilkins himself finds that he has to defend his position, so he writes this pamphlet. It's called The Single Issue in the Robert Williams Case, and here he goes on to elaborate. There's no issue of self-defense. We've always upheld self-defense. And later that year at a fundraising dinner in Chicago, he gets the question, and his answer is, of course we must defend ourselves. This is our right under all known laws. Again, this is sort of robust support of the idea of armed self-defense. And the Williams controversy goes on, and I've given you enough detail there, but there's some of these statements that are just so rich that I think I'll burden you with them. So one comes from James Farmer, who was the first black chair of a corps, but was more pacifist than his successor, William McKinsey. And Farmer's statement when asked in an interview about the corps, the increasing radicalization of corps in the South, in these sharecroppers and folks who were living with sharecroppers in Mississippi, who had decided that it was appropriate to do what they always had done, that is, to defend themselves with firearms. Foreman says, this is entirely consistent with our principle. And here's the quote. When a man's home is attacked, that's not the movement. That's his home. It's just this blatant statement. It's obvious. You ought to know this. The more colorful rendition comes from Hartman Turma, who I guess died 5 or 6 years ago. There's a nice piece about him in the Wall Street Journal. And you see him. He's a simple man, but he's a tough, hard-eyed guy. And he was one of the local supporters of CORE and engaged in lots of organizing activity. And he was, one night his house was attacked, shot up by the Klan, and then bombed, caught on fire. He pushes his family out the back door, drags his rifle off the wall, and fires away. And later, when he's asked about it, he says, "I wasn't being non-violent." This is his word. "I wasn't being non-violent. I was just protecting my family." Others say the same thing. So Charles Edwards talking about his murdered brother, Medgar. "Medgar and Merle were barricaded in at home. Medgar was non-violent, but he had 6 guns in the kitchen and living room." And this goes on and on and on. And Charles Edwards is even more active in terms of his support for armed self-defense. So this is a summary, but this is the same theme that was pressed early on by Frederick Douglass, who urged the good revolver as a response to kidnap, but who also urged that one not go over the line into this era, to this area of political violence. So that raises the question, and this is what I pursue in the last part of the paper, that is, what happened? How do we find ourselves in the midst of a modern orthodoxy where the author of the NAACP's brief in Heller later writes an article suggesting that the diminution of or the reversal of Heller ought to be part of any civil rights agenda? That is, you can't be on the right side of the civil rights issue unless you are committed to overturning Heller, which strikes some of us, particularly me, as odd. So the answer to the question, what happened, is to some degree complicated. And I have something that I think is more than a theory. This is the place where I think my research requires more effort than I have yet put in terms of making the firmest case possible for sort of cause and effect. But as you'll see in the paper, the thing that I try to illustrate is this period of converging trends in the period from mid-1960 through sort of the mid-1970s that explains the sort of puzzle that you see at the beginning of the paper. So at the beginning of the paper, I give you this quote from Ida B. Wells, "The Winchester rifle ought to be, or should have a place of honor in every Negro home." And 100 years later, we get a very different statement from Eleanor Holmes Norton, whose view is basically reflective of the strategic dichotomy that is no one should have firearms, essentially, and that people ought to rely on the state. How do we get here? We get here by, I'll call it 3 things. So first, in the 1960s, the strategic dichotomy that I identify is really very much rough-handled by the rising black radical groups that start to create this idea, oppress this idea, that self-defense and political violence are really the same thing. So you see this in the doctrine espoused by Malcolm X, you see it in the doctrine espoused by the Black Panthers, the Black Liberation Group, so all, and to some degree, the more radicalized CORE group. Which is basically the notion that self-defense against an individual and self-defense against the state, self-defense against the sort of oppression that people were feeling, that those were the same thing. Well, that obliterates the strategic dichotomy, at least from the perspective of the speaker. And the question now is whether the more conservative integrationist groups are going to uphold it or whether they're going to adjust. And the thing that I argue here is that they, in fact, adjust it. So here's the context. The leadership is in crisis. That is, the NAACP and CORE and SNCC and SCLC and other lesser groups are still sort of competing for who's going to emerge as the predominant group. The cities are burning. You've got the black establishment sort of unconnected to the violence that is occurring in the cities and certainly unable to control it, to harness it. This is also the point at which the modern gun control movement sort of reemerges and is enveloped into the fold of the progressive coalition that eventually will be an important driver for the kind of a success and political victories that the black establishment can claim. And just as an aside, I guess I should indicate to you that in the original iteration, this article was called Gun Control in the Black Establishment. And my take at the time was that there was this clear schism between the black establishment and the people and folks at the grassroots, and that turned out to be, turned out to make the piece twice as long as it currently is. So what you have now is sort of the bare bones version of a longer piece that argues that really what we're seeing in terms of the modern orthodoxy is a reflection of the interests of a black political class that is more beholden to this progressive alliance than maybe are people at the grassroots. Now, how do I illustrate this? I do it again bit by bit, but there's this really nice piece where I think, again, we get an indication basically of the theme. This is August 1966. This is an episode of Meet the Press, which maybe is still on, but in the old days of network TV, it was a big deal being on Meet the Press, meant that everybody the next day was going to be talking about what occurred on Meet the Press on Sunday. So this was, and you can see in the old photographs, you can actually see that there are four black conservatives, integrationists, sitting at one tier, and then three or four of the radicals on top. So the conservatives are King, Roy Wilkins, Whitney Young of the Urban League. The radicals higher up and looking down on them are James Meredith, Stokely Carmichael, and Floyd McKissick of CORE. And the questioning starts, and this is one of the places where I've still got some work to do. It starts actually with Lawrence Spivak posing to Martin Luther King a question that presupposes the strategic dichotomy that I've been talking about. And he says, well, there's a difference between self-defense and nonviolence, right? Everybody believes in self-defense, and I understand that Dr. King and one of the others are in agreement on this. Now, McKissick responds in a way that's sort of equivocal, and here's what you get from King. So King says, now realize the context, and think about how we talked earlier and how King talked earlier about the strategic dichotomy in the context of the Robert Williams affair, where he was very, very explicit and clear about the dividing line between political violence and self-defense. Well, here, he submerges it. The theme is still there, so you can find it, but it is barely recognizable. So he starts, I believe firmly in nonviolence. I think to turn to violence at this point would be impractical and immoral. Mr. McKissick believes that, and I certainly agree with him. Now, listen carefully. On the question of defensive violence, I have made it clear that I don't think we need programmatic action around defensive violence. I don't know what that means, but let's read on. People are going to defend themselves anyway. All right, that's sounding a little bit like the strategic dichotomy. Then he says, I think the minute you have programmatic action around defensive violence and pronouncements about it, the line of demarcation between defensive violence and aggressive violence becomes very thin. This is that strategic dichotomy again we're talking about. The minute the nomenclature of violence gets into the atmosphere, people begin to respond violently, and in their unsophisticated minds, they cannot quite make the distinction between defensive and aggressive violence. So he's still giving us the strategic dichotomy, but now masked in a way that makes this entire statement sound like I'm a big nonviolent guy, except embedded in here clearly is, except when it comes to self-defense, then people are going to do that on their own. I just don't think we need a program about self-defense. But even at the height of the movement, at the height of the riot, at the place where this notion of embracing the strategic dichotomy threatens the kinds of alliances that blacks were trying to forge with white progressives and others, King is still on in support of the basic idea of armed self-defense, but he's worried about what comes next. And the next part is this, just very quickly, so you'll see this all excerpted in the text, and this is probably around footnote 340-350, depending on which version you have. So Spivak asks then Meredith and Carmichael, after some round and round, you're not suggesting political violence, are you? And Meredith says, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. And then Carmichael, if you don't want us to do it, who's going to do it? They go on and on. This is a place where if you're sitting there, you're thinking, all right, I'm a member, I'm Roy Wilkins, who a year before, 2 years before, made this statement to the NAACP saying, listen, we quite clearly believe in and always have supported private self-defense, but we're not going to engage in this agenda of political violence. Now, what's the odd? What's the benefit to you of standing up and making that distinction when you've got these people in the press who, for their own benefit, and in a way that arguably is to the detriment of the broader movement and maybe to the detriment of the NAACP, are you still going to stand up and maintain this distinction, or are you still going to elevate the value of self-defense? This is a place where we start to see the leadership support for armed self-defense eroding. The other thing that happens is, during the same period, the leadership, that is the modern black establishment that I pushed harder on in earlier versions of the paper, starts to get benefits from the progressive coalition. So the war on poverty, the spoils to the black underclass. The Civil Rights Acts during the period of the 1960s, where suddenly we start to see more blacks registered to vote, black mayors start to rise, people start to get appointed as in the executive branch. Now, suddenly, I'm in control. I'm Maynard Jackson. I'm the mayor of Atlanta. Now I've got a problem. How do I control crime and violence within my new domain? So Maynard Jackson, by 1976, is the chairman of the National Coalition to Ban Handguns, writes an article in one of the Carolina Law Reviews urging absolute gun bans as essential for saving black lives. And if you find yourself suddenly in control, realizing, gee, this is actually sort of a difficult thing to do, how do I clamp down on crime? How do I generate better statistics next year than I had this year? Then if people in your coalition, the coalition that brought you to power, are urging a kind of new and untested but not absurd sounding notion, just get rid of the guns and everything will be okay, will you embrace that? Absolutely. This is the place where, this is the time where, the modern orthodoxy starts to emerge. But this orthodoxy is, on the long view, just an aberration. So it continues, it's not an aberration. But on the long view, does not represent practice and policy of the community that I think I can detail from 1850 at least through the middle of the 1950s. So what happens then? What about the folks at the grassroots? This again is a piece of the paper that I've actually taken out and pushed aside it because it's even more political and arguably less historical. That is, I think I've got to do empirical work in order to make this claim. But my argument is this, that whatever is happening in terms of the pressing and development of the modern orthodoxy by the modern black establishment, that doesn't necessarily reflect what's happening at the grassroots. And here, the data about ownership of firearms in the black community is underdeveloped and a number of other questions are underdeveloped in a way that I'll tell you that here's one of my other claims, but it doesn't make it into the text. It strikes me that at the grassroots, there is a significant departure from the modern orthodox, if for no other reason than the fact that when I go home, everybody I know had guns and still has guns. And on this question of firearms ownership, they are as consistent on the question of firearms ownership and armed self-defense as anyone historically would have been. So partly it's just starting with my people, who do I know? All my folks say, yeah, you're right. I don't know why that's so surprising. Or I go to New York, obviously, and teach my firearms class or talk to my colleagues, people think, where do you get this from? And my answer is from my dad and his dad and all of those folks. But The other, and then there's this other ethical information. So go to gun shows. Go to gun shows in Philadelphia. All kinds of brown-looking people. Strikes me that, and again, I haven't yet been able to prove it empirically, that there is indeed a divide between the modern orthodoxy, as you would get it from Eleanor Holmes Norton or anybody in the Congressional Black Caucus, versus what you would find in the community as a whole. Now, my actual support for that, other than the sort of trite anecdotes, is that within the Black Church, and there actually is more data on this, within the Black Church, you've got good evidence of a kind of social conservatism that is at odds with many of the things on the agenda of the left. So while it is true that the holdover from the Civil Rights era continues to cause Black folks to pull the lever for Democrats, and I think that will continue, I think that's a more complicated question, issue by issue, on the platform of the party, and particularly on the question of firearms ownership, I think that the community is more at odds with the modern orthodoxy than is the establishment. And while I can say that here, I took it out of the paper just because it's more inflammatory, and I think the law reviews are not going to like it, and maybe it'll make its way into a book. Maybe it requires more empirical support in order to sustain. Last part of the piece is simply to say that the things have changed argument that Maynard Jackson and lots of other folks in the modern Black establishment would advance as a justification for saying, well, now we can trust the state because now we are the state. Well, first of all, you know, you are not the state, not always. And you might be able to say that in Chicago. Harold Washington used to be the mayor, but the current mayor of Chicago is, you know, you ask, he's a friend to the minority community, but maybe he's not. But that defies the idea that we are now the state. And worse than that, the notion that things have changed because now we are the state suggests that the justification for armed self-defense is that the state is malevolent. That's not the justification. It's simply state failure. There's a window of imminence within which the state cannot respond. It's compounded by limitations on resources that are worse in certain communities. And to the degree that the government, the state, has ever been a savior for the Black community, maybe you could make that argument over the long term. It only took 100 years in the context of the federal government, if you track from Reconstruction to the 1960s. But it's very hard to make that argument for purposes of your assessment of state and local governments, and more particularly for the agents of state and local governments. So those people who say the state is our savior, they're thinking about the federal government. We got a movie, I think, well, that was a pretty long damn time. And I might be one of those people who thinks that was tardy enough, so I'm still not going to trust the federal government. But now you have to move to the state level, then you got to move to the local level, and then you have to move to the actual individuals, that is, the agents of the state, who, by the way, are targets of just stinging criticism by the civil rights establishment, more the contradiction that I was talking about before. And the last piece is really more abstract, that is, that state failure has been in the advocacy for advancement of rights by feminist scholars and other progressives, that state failure has been the foundation of arguments for extension of reproductive rights and for extension of the right to self-defense in the case of battered women. And oddly, in the context of race, the notion of state failure seems to be submerged on the view that, well, it's no longer malicious. That one strikes me as odd as well. And then the reassessment piece is just a variety of ways of trying to convince free-thinking, open-minded folks in the community to consider this issue from the perspective of innocence, from the perspective of people like Shelley Parker and Otis McDonald, and not from the perspective of some politician who has a very difficult decision to make and who has made a decision to sacrifice certain particular interests of self-preservation in order to pursue a kind of broader community agenda. So that's the piece, and again, I've summarized it in ways that hopefully capture sort of the essence of it, and I look forward to your comments and getting the answers. Mike?
Okay.
It's
probably fair to say that Heller's conception of the Second Amendment kind of embodies the strategic vector. And not perfectly, that's an oversimplification, because there is some mention of the tyranny control function of the right, but it's at least true, for example, that the Supreme Court said personal defense is the central component of the right, hunting's part of it too, and even though the right was codified partially to deter a tyrannical government, we're not going to use the anti-tyranny function to give content to the right. You don't have a right to own machine guns. Unfortunately, that was just a premise, because what I was going to say is, if you accept that, when I'm speaking with students or lawyers in the community or community groups that are, you know, kind of from the Jeffersonian dissident conservative wing of American politics, kind of the Tea Party wing, an important political formation in America today, they criticize Heller in terms that suggest that, kind of from the other side of the coin, they agree with the mainstream, the civil rights community consensus today, that personal violence and public violence should rise and fall together, and they reject the strategic dichotomy kind of from the other view, and they say, hey, where's the, you know, what if Heller didn't give enough recognition to the right to own guns and use them to overthrow the government?
Okay, no, I get it, and I understand. I mean, if you were crafting the decision in Heller, you would have done it exactly that way, partly because the question of tyranny and the militia issue was just not part, wasn't one of the claims. So in that sense, I can understand, I would understand it and do understand Heller as silent on the issue, although I wouldn't suggest that Heller, other than by implication of saying that the core of the right is this self-defense within the context of the home. I wouldn't say that Heller completely dismissed the idea of the sort of political value of the armed populace. But I would distinguish that, I mean, you draw the parallel, and I see it roughly, but there's a difference. And the difference here is that for purposes of political minorities, and this actually gets interesting with some of the issues that George and I talked about, for purposes of political minorities, the notion of using violence to achieve your ends is more problematic, because the issue always is, how do you define tyranny, and when are you properly, as a community, rising up and defending yourself against tyranny or overthrowing tyranny? You know, is it, if the people in this room got together and decided we didn't like what was going on, wherever we are, east of here, west of here, is our discontent enough to justify that sort of political violence? I think the answer is pretty clearly no. You go to some of the debates around the crisis of 1800, but some of the debates around where you get Jefferson making statements about how would we go about this process of engaging in political violence? Well, it would take a kind of consensus from a number of states. Well, that suggests a legitimacy to the violence that is not present in the context of violence by political minorities, and also a kind of practicality to the violence that is not present in the context of this violence by political minorities that you see Douglas and everyone else thinking is folly. So it's not just practicality. I think it's kind of normative distinction that all the black people in the country, if we got together, and it's an interesting question, if we got together and said, all right, this is what Carmichael proposed. This is really horrible, and we're going to get together, and we're going to take everybody down. That's actually what he said on Meet the Press. That sounds like a kind of, I mean, that's the suicide pact that, I forget who wrote the article that was titled that. And so I think this notion of gaining a kind of core mass of legitimacy through preliminary pseudo-democratic procedures is an important distinction between violence by the majority in the militia context or the resistance against tyranny context versus the kind of violence that you see eschewed in the strategic dichotomy or under the strategic dichotomy. Joyce?
Yeah, I think that's extraordinarily interesting work that you've been doing. And I hope that, if not in this article, that in some other place you go into whether the grassroots agrees with the leadership of these organizations. I think that's extremely important. And necessary. And I think a lot of the leadership of organizations tends to get a drift from what the ordinary people they're supposedly representing are for. I think with the black community, for instance, on school choice, there's a...
I was gonna mention it, you could, yeah, absolutely.
So, I know it's hard to get at what, you know, ordinary people are feeling about these things, but if there's some way that you can...
I'm thinking I actually gotta do empirical work here, which I've never really done, and this is hard to do. It's hard to get this, it's hard to do the sampling, it's hard to get the kind of honest assessment from people who I think, in this is an area where people know what they're supposed to say. And overcoming that, I think is difficult.
The cultural reference, I was thinking about, you know, what I've seen in the cultural media, African-American embracing guns in different places. But the one that struck me the most was thinking about Tyler Perry's Madea.
Okay.
Who carries a gun very aggressively to use it to defend her personal rights and the personal rights of her family. And that's a really traditional view of Second Amendment rights.
Well, and it's, you know, I've been talking about the high-minded empiricism, but there are a variety of places in the popular culture where you see grandma armed, grandpa armed. There was a show that didn't make it through three episodes where Felicia Rashad, or one of the Rashad sisters, was a character, and her brother was the country boy. And in the black community, you're country ass, you don't know that. My parents and grandparents would all talk about it, but we're all country. Country boy in this sitcom. His most notable thing was he carried 2 6 guns, and whenever he got excited, he did that. Now that was the Hollywood stereotype. But your reference to Madea and there, you know, there are a bunch of these reflect something that people know. That is, oh, your country cousins have guns. And so part of this, I'm thinking, is maybe a breakdown between a kind of rural environment and an urban environment, or rural versus really inner city, urban, underclass, urban. I mean, there's so many ways to slice this that I'm worried about how to do the sampling, and I'm not sure that I have, in fact, the kind of cultural connection to the modern urban underclass that allows me to sort of appreciate all of those concerns. My connection is actually these rural folks who were universally armed.
Thank you very much, Professor Johnson. We have a magnifying glass.